Suzanne Vega is sitting in the morning.
I am sitting in the morning.
In her hotel room outside of Chicago, where she played the night before. And she's logging into Zoom. She's on the road with her longtime musical partner in crime, Jerry Leonard, at a moment of transition, a dividing line of her own devising between retrospection and renewal. And I'm just happy to bear witness for a little while on this Zoom call we're having. There are artists who define a moment, and then there are artists who stretch beyond any single moment, who continue to reflect and to resonate over time. Suzanne Vega is one of those. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. For me and for many of my generation, she's been a fact of life for as long as we've been listening. With her first hit, Luca, a haunting ballad with a serious subject matter that somehow became a mainstream hit, which was followed by Tom's Diner, a song that started out as an a cappella sketch and became a surprise dance anthem, and then a digital milestone. Suzanne Vega found a way to do the unexpected, quietly. She says that she thinks she's somehow been a conduit for the ideas of the era. And I know why she feels that way. Her album Nine Objects of Desire, which was produced by her then-husband and longtime creative partner Mitchell Froom, expanded her sound and her scope and pushed the boundaries of what singer-songwriters could be in the modern era. That album still holds a place in my heart and on my desert island list.
So goodbye, sweet appetite. No single bite could satisfy. I know your name. I know your skin.
So I went to go see her perform in Queens last fall as part of her Old Songs, New Songs, and Other Songs tour. It was a set that looked backwards and forwards at once. And that night planted the seed for this conversation. When we eventually spoke, her new record, Flying with Angels, was just about to be released. It's her first collection of original songs in nearly a decade.
I'm flying with angels. I'm hovering low, then going high. Know how it happened. Suddenly I am in the sky.
So we talked about that record, about the arc of her career, and about what it means to keep showing up honestly as a witness, as a writer, and just as a person, year after year. Third-story.com is the place to visit the archive. Hundreds of deep dives like this one, including past conversations with other groundbreaking and heartbreaking singer-songwriters like Ani DeFranco, Martin Sexton, Jonathan Brooke, Ron Sexsmith, Louise Goffin, Donald Fagen, Beth Nielsen Chapman, Boz Scaggs, Imogen Heap, Duncan Sheik, Madeleine Peru, Daniel Lanois, Paula Cole, Dan Zanes, S.G. Goodman, Warren Zanes, Stephen Merritt. Ooh, wow. That is a nice little list, and it's not even the complete one. Go check it all out at third-story.com. And also visit the Substack for the latest writings, episodes, and to subscribe to the mailing list. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning programming. Here's me and Suzanne Vega talking it down.
You're in the middle of a long thread of shows that you've been doing with your longtime musical partner, Jerry Leonard, that actually look not so much to the future, but to the past. A lot of retrospective stories and songs. So where are you right now in that mix of getting ready to put a record out, but also still kind of doing that show with Jerry that looks backwards? Like, you've spent a lot of time looking at your catalog and telling stories about it.
Well, I kind of have to. I mean, I have a really big catalog at this point, and that's what people know me for. I think it would be really annoying if I went on tour and just decided to focus on new material. I've always disliked it when I go to see an artist and I love the old material and all they want to do is sing the new stuff that we don't know. So I think all of my tours have had an element of retrospection because the first two albums I did were so successful. I mean, most people know me from that era. So I like to do the old songs because it's comforting for them and me. And then I like to do, you know, the new material because you have to, and because it's, you know, the new material eventually becomes old. And then the other songs are usually like, you know, covers, or though sometimes we'll throw in Blood Makes Noise if we're in the mood for that, or you know, it gives us a little wild card to play with.
I'm glad you brought up the early success of those first records because, you know, I think it's something with many artists who have early hits and then have an expansive career after that, what the relationship is with those hits and with that material over time. You recognize it as a responsibility. Is it a burden? Is it a privilege or both? What is it like for you to know that that's expected of you? No matter what you do, there are certain songs that you know are going to follow you on stage.
Yeah, I think of it as a privilege. I really do. I think of my career as being like this sort of ice cream sundae, and then I have my two hits, and those are like the cherries on the top. There's nothing to complain about here. That's how I feel. I think it's all great.
When I saw you in Queens a few months ago, 6 months ago, and heard you play your hits, I mean, you have your two big hits, but you also have other songs you're associated with and that people love. But I was thinking about your two big hits and how unlikely they each are as hits. And if a person were going to try to map out a career and think, okay, well, then I'll make my song, my commercial song, or I'll do my thing that'll connect. Neither one of them, I mean, one of them is clearly a surprise, but the other one, even Luca, is such an unlikely subject matter to have resonated.
I agree with you. I thought that when my manager came to me in 1984, right after I wrote the song, and he said, is this a song about child abuse? And I said, yes. And he said, I think it could be a hit. And I was so skeptical because at that point, it was an intimate acoustic song about child abuse, which I just thought of it as a small song about a small subject. He felt that it was a song about an issue. And he was complaining that songs in the 80s weren't about issues anymore, that in the 70s, we had songs about ending the war and we had songs about issues. But in the 80s, that had sort of gone away. The thing both songs have in common is they had a really great radio-friendly production. Because once Luca became produced, it became a different animal. And I guess he heard in the melody and in the simplicity of the song itself that it could lend itself to a pop treatment, which I couldn't really. I was like, whatever. I was like, do what you want. Just don't change the lyrics. And I'm not going to dress or act any differently. So just deal with that. So they did. And it took about 2 years for them to produce it to the point where it was ready to go to radio. And once it went to radio, it just took off.
My name is Luca. I live on the second floor. I live upstairs from you. Yes, I think you've seen me before.
So while Solitude Standing was being made, there was an understanding already from management or the whoever was working with you, the producers, that this would be the focus track?
Yeah. And at that point, my management were also my producers. Complicated deal with my managers was sort of, so that's the way that worked. And it worked out for us. It worked really, really well. Steve Adabo and Lenny Kaye did the production and they worked really hard on it. And I have to say, the minute it went to radio, it just took off. It was a hit. That's what a hit does. It just explodes.
When I moved to New York 20 years ago, one of the first studios that I worked in was Shelter Island. And I met Steve back then. And so I know him. And I remember walking into the room that I felt like, oh, I'm walking into the room that Luca built. This is what a hit does. It permeates and it resonates. It vibrates through all kinds of people's lives. Not only your lives, but all these people that are associated with a hit, you know, are forever changed.
Yes, yes. That's right. That's right.
So that's so interesting that it took 2 years and that they had the sense of their own responsibility to get this right. And if they got it right, that it would land. And they were right. They knew what a hit was.
Yeah, because actually we had Luca. Luca was written before the first album was recorded. So we had to choose what we were going to put on the first album, what was going to make a presentation. But at that point, it was only a year old, and we were still finding our way. So we decided to save Luca for the second album, which I think was the right thing to do. Yeah. So for the first album, we deliberately chose songs that were both very folky and then other songs like Cracking, which were more experimental.
But you did have a little breakout hit on the first album, especially in Europe, in the UK, with Marlena on the Wall.
Surprise.
That was another surprise?
To me, it was. Yeah. I remember thinking when I wrote it that it wasn't one of my best, that it was kind of obscure, that there are all these really private references to my own things going on in my own personal life. So I remember thinking, I don't think anyone's going to know what I'm talking about. But my guitarist at the time, John Gordon, pointed out that it was an up-tempo song in a major key. And so therefore, we were going to perform it because we had so few songs that were in major keys. I prefer minor ones. I think in a sense, again, that's sort of what made the impact, and then people could sort of fill in the details themselves as they heard it.
Even if I am in love with you, all this to say, what's it to you? Observe the blood, the rose tattoo of the fingerprint on me from you. Other evidence has shown that you and I are still alone. We skirt around the danger zone and don't talk about it later. Marlena watches from the wall. Her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall.
Well, it seems like that's kind of a theme that runs throughout your writing. I think people don't necessarily know what you're talking about all the time. You're very descriptive, and at the same time, you leave a lot of room for people to sort of project their own movie onto your screen, and it seems to have worked. People feel very connected to the material, even if they don't necessarily know what your intention was with it or what you mean.
Yeah, and in some ways, I think it's almost better that people can bring their own details and their own emotional experiences to the songs and find themselves in the songs. I really like that. I feel like that's important. What I'm feeling and thinking matters up to a point, but once you put the song out there, you need it to resonate with the audience.
Mm.
I leave room for that.
When it comes to Luca, you know, I was a young boy when that song was on the radio, and I just sang along with it like every other song that I listened to on the radio. It was just a hit. It was a fact of life.
Yeah.
Later on, when I realized what it was about, I mean, there were a few songs, like I think about Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, which came out a couple years later, that I think was following in the same sort of spirit of a pop song that grew out of the folk scene,
mm-hmm.
that was also songwriter as advocate, songwriter as truth teller, something bigger than hit maker. Like you were representing something larger than the record business in that.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
Did you start to feel that people wanted to know what you thought about larger subjects in the world after that? Did people turn to you? What does Suzanne Vega think about this or that or the other thing?
No, I don't think it was like that. Although, I mean, around that time was when I started to become aware that there was such a thing as human rights and amnesty. I was involved with Amnesty for a while. For a while, actually, I was going to be on the Human Rights Now tour. And then they switched, and then Tracy Chapman was on that tour, and she was appropriate for it. So it was really more that I was feeling like, oh, there's a thing out there in the world, it's called human rights, and here they are. They're written down. You can see them. This was exciting to me. Whether people want to hear my thoughts or not, I work with socially conscious organizations and try and help out whenever I can. But I don't really like the soapbox approach in spite of the fact I have the song Speaker's Corner, which is about that very thing. I've always tried to stay away from that kind of writing because, you know, unless you're Bob Dylan and you're so brilliant at it because he can be both personal and political in the same song, in the same verse, I find a lot of it very strident and I don't really resonate with it. So I try to do what I like.
Have a newfound sympathy for the madman in the square. Rants and raves his rhetoric to the midday air. His heartfelt pleas and arguments, but the sense no longer there. The sound ascends to heaven like the incense in a prayer. Speaker's Corner, there it stands. Politics a song. Trying everything you feel, whether it is right or wrong.
Thank you for drawing that parallel between Luca and Speaker's Corner. It's not a direct parallel, but that's exactly why I asked that question, because I've read at maybe in your bio or press release or some interview where you said, you know, the storyteller's job is not to describe necessarily what is known. It is to, I'm paraphrasing, it is to give an idea of what is possible or to paint a picture of something you haven't seen. And yet, something like Speaker's Corner, and not only Speaker's Corner, but also the song that launched this batch of songs about Mariupol,
right,
are songs that are kind of bearing witness to something that is happening, not painting a picture of what could be, but actually reporting what you are seeing right now.
That's true. I mean, that's kind of a shift for me. I'm not sure that I would encourage this in myself, but the songs, I very often feel like they choose me and I try to execute them the best way I can. And I have to say, I found the invasion of Ukraine in the spring of 2022 was all over the news constantly. It was like the lead story every night at 6 o'clock. And it was happening in real time in the media. We could see it. And yet you felt like there was nothing that we could actually do. So I think that's why I was haunted by these images of people fleeing for their lives by train. Everyone was packing themselves onto these trains and leaving. And so when they invaded the town of Mariupol, I thought, what a beautiful name.
Mm-hmm.
So I created this sort of fantasy final train that was leaving. And then I read in the New York Times that people were saying that even God himself was fleeing because of what was happening there. And I thought, okay, so God is fleeing on this train.
Mm-hmm.
And by using images from the news on TV and getting news from the New York Times, I just made 4 snapshots and left it at that.
There's a last train from Mariupol. Mariupol, oh Mariupol. Last train from Mariupol. See how the platform is heaving. Who's on the train from Mariupol, Mariupol, oh, Mariupol. Who's on the train from Mariupol? All of humanity fleeing.
As we were kind of exploring your 2 big hits, the other one that we didn't talk about yet is Tom's Diner, which is so not only unpredictable, but also something that I think as an artist, one would have to kind of confront the possibility. Imagine that something that I made that exists in one realm was repurposed, and it is that repurposed thing that becomes the hit, and then that's the thing that follows you around. What was your take on that when you first heard the remix and when it became successful and over all these years living with it? What is your relationship with that song like?
Oh, I loved it from the moment I heard it. I thought it was very funny, and I thought that it was very clever. And I thought this will, first of all, I grew up in very mixed neighborhoods. And so I just felt in my bones that it was something that could translate and that the kids from my old neighborhood would love it. And so I thought this is really cool. I remember discussing a long time ago, around the time I wrote Tom's Diner, I was talking to someone and they were saying it's silly to get upset about a remake of a song, a cover of a song, or a different production treatment because it always exists in the original. So there's no point in getting hysterical over it. Just don't listen to it. If you don't like it, just don't listen to it because it will still exist in its original form. There's no need to choose, you know. So I already had that in my mind when I heard this remix. And I thought, great, we'll buy it from them. We'll release it and it'll be a little club hit and it'll be funny. So, and then instead it became one of the most played songs on R&B stations that year. So in a way, it expressed a part of my life that I hadn't thought to do myself, you know, because I came from those neighborhoods. And I thought, oh, this is great.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm still friends with the DNA guys and I see them from time to time.
This thing about not getting upset about your song being repurposed or remixed or whatever. I mean, part of what was happening there was that it sort of collided with the technology of remixing at that time. And you had kind of inadvertently dropped an a cappella. You know, a lot of times now this happens where people put out their a cappellas and let other DJs remix them or whatever. You just happened to put an a cappella out that was just like sitting there waiting for somebody to scoop it up.
Yeah. The reason we did it a cappella is because I had a soundtrack in my mind, but I'm not technically, I don't know anything about music theory. I couldn't write the music myself. So rather than wait for the music to somehow get into the picture, I just started doing it a cappella. And it worked every time, especially as an opening song. I could silence a room just by starting that song. Mm. And people would whirl around and look to see what I was doing. And it worked for huge audiences and small ones. So I thought, let's just be brave and record it a cappella and put it out that way, because that's how we perform it. And that sort of changed things for me.
Yeah. It is a very brave thing to do.
Thanks. I thought it was. The other interesting thing is that when I met the guys from DNA, I said, why did you do that? I mean, what made you think of that? And they said, we're fans of yours. And then they said the rhythm was already in the song. And if we hadn't done it, someone else would have done it, because the rhythm was already there in the music. And we just put the beat to it.
That track was also used in the development of the MP3 technology.
Yeah, Karlheinz Brandenburg was working on the MP3 in the late 80s. And I guess I had known that like Philip Glass would use that song to test the PA systems, because it's such a bare, clean vocal that it shows up any issues with the amplification. So Karlheinz Brandenburg decided to run it through. And I got to hear what it sounded like before they refined the MP3, because he was expecting it to come through clean as a perfect replication. And it sounded like Linda Blair in The Exorcist. Because for that devil voice, they used distorted electronic voice to do that devil voice. And so my voice came out sounding like that. Mm-hmm. And so he spent months running the song through it and doing whatever they do in those laboratories to get it to be the MP3 that we know.
So your limitation in not knowing how to find the music that you imagined in your head with this song led to an a cappella recording that spawned a remix that became a huge hit.
Yes.
And the creation of the MP3, or the help of the development of the MP3.
Right. Isn't that interesting? I mean, somehow I've been a conduit for certain ideas. And in a way, it's because of the simplicity of what I did, you know, it's elemental. So it's been a kind of conduit for ideas of the era.
I think the simplicity of what you do is a great image in general. I was listening to the new record and you sound the same. You know, you sound totally unchanged to me.
I take it as a compliment. Thank you.
I mean it as a compliment.
Yeah.
And it's there it is. There's that familiar delivery, there's that familiar voice, there's that familiar phrasing, there's that familiar persona. So much of it is in the clarity and unfussiness about the way it's presented and delivered. That simplicity of voice. Was it something that you had to find, or was it always there for you when you started writing and singing?
I think it was there conceptually, but I had to work on it. In some ways, my vocal phrasing, some of that came from working with Steve Adabo, because from time to time, I would try and affect a persona. You know, when we were working on Luca, there was a time when I was singing it, I was going, you know, my name is Luca, I live on the second floor, and I was trying to be like pop, and so I was saying, I live upstairs from you, and he told me to stop doing that. He said, don't do that. So I stopped and I realized it was just better, simpler. Mm-hmm. I love this from you. You know, you don't have to get all like, put your persona into it. Just do it. Plain. And that works for me. And that's something that I guess when I'm working with kids, I tell them that sometimes your style is defined by your limitations. And it's very true with me.
You talk about on stage, you've made reference to it in various places, that seeing Lou Reed was the sort of event or one of the events that kind of gave you a sense, oh, I want to do this. This is the world I want to be in.
Yeah.
What was it about Lou Reed that did that to you?
It was his songwriting as well as his delivery. The more I got to know about his world, the more intrigued I became. I mean, because at first I have to say I was sort of repelled. I didn't really know anything about rock and roll music. I didn't really like it. I liked folk music. I liked Bob Dylan. I liked Leonard Cohen. I liked acoustic music. But when I saw Reed, his storytelling is so blunt and so plain, and there's no metaphors, or it's just like reportage, but at the same time, you know who's speaking. He's not neutral. He's a very antagonistic sort of character. So the more I got to know about his songwriting, the more I felt I could learn from it. And the fascinating thing, too, is the first album I bought from him was the Berlin album. And I was amazed to find that a lot of it is played on the acoustic guitar. And then now later in life, we see these demo tapes of Lou Reed playing acoustic guitar. So I was drawn to that. I was like, oh, see, here's what you can do with an acoustic guitar and a story and a character and a situation. You don't have to hide it or get mystical about it, although you can. But, you know, I go to Lou Reed when I want clarity and truth, you know. At his best, I think that's what he provides.
Caroline says, as she gets up off the floor, why is it that you beat me? It isn't any fun.
So if you go to Lou Reed for clarity and truth, what do you want when you turn to Leonard Cohen?
I want mystery and this sort of strange overlapping of sensuality and like politics and mysticism and atmosphere. That's what I go to Leonard Cohen for, all those things.
It's interesting that you say that. I read this morning briefly the first third of an interview between you and Leonard Cohen. I think he technically was interviewing you 25 years ago or something. And the kind of flirty way of communicating that he just had was flying off the page to me as soon as I started reading it. And yet it immediately turns to the artistic process. It was all there. It was sensual and existential and poetic and big and small and highbrow and lowbrow all at the same time. And it felt like, oh, it's so Leonard Cohen, this conversation.
Yes, it really was. And the other thing to know is that during that hour, he was having wine and, you know, and I didn't have any wine because there was no way I was going to get tipsy while I was dealing with Leonard Cohen in conversation. The other thing is we went out after this interview and we had dinner. And he was a very different persona. Yeah, so he could turn on the flirtatious thing on and off when he wanted to, because a lot of that suddenly it became a lot more just like regular people talking. It wasn't that Leonard Cohen thing.
Huh. And yet the thing that we all kind of take from him is that we sort of feel like we know him, but maybe it was a slightly manicured version of him that we got to know. Maybe it wasn't the total picture.
I think there was a more down-to-earth Leonard Cohen. Yeah. I'll give you a little anecdote. He gave me his phone number once and he said, call me when you're in town. So I did. I was in Montreal. It was my birthday. And I said, can I meet you for breakfast or something? And he said, no. And I said, oh, but you said, you know, and he said, no, no, the world is too much with me. And I said, but what does that mean? It's not fair. It's my birthday. And he said, I'm waiting for a furniture delivery. And I thought, oh, okay. Oh, that's what you mean.
But you don't say I'm waiting for a furniture delivery. Oh, you say the world is too much for me.
The world is too much with me, which, I mean, that's pure. Well, it's Shakespeare, but isn't it Shakespeare? I think it is. But it's so Leonard to quote that.
Yeah. We were talking about the Mariupol song, and, you know, it seems like it sort of arrived. You said songs choose you, which I love. But it's also like this batch of songs that came in the last couple of years seems to be the first original batch, at least that you recorded in quite a while.
Yeah.
What was happening during that break? And what is your relationship with writing like today? Did it change during the pause? Were you writing the whole time but choosing not to record? Did you step away from writing?
I think what happened was that things started to open up for me in terms of the theater. I wrote a one-woman play about the writer Carson McCullers. And so between 2011 and 2019, I did two productions of that play. One was in New York and one was down in Houston, Texas. And in between those two productions, we put out the album. And then we finished in 2019 by doing the film of the play. So now I felt like, okay, I've spent just about 10 years on this. Working in the theater is very different than writing an album. It takes up a lot of time. There's a lot of teamwork. You spend months rehearsing and preparing, and then you have to do the run of the show. So I think a lot of time was spent there. And then, I was doing a lot of touring and other things like that. But once I finished with the play in the film form, and once COVID hit, and I thought it's time to get back to basics.
Yeah, and you had time. You're not on the road. COVID, we were all at home. Right?
I didn't write a lot during COVID years. I was too anxious. I took a lot of notes, and some of them have made it into this album. Mm-hmm. The song Rats, that has a lot of COVID landscape, ambulances, this a feeling of desolation in New York. I stayed in New York, and a lot of people left. But you had definitely had the animal presence because the people had gone away. So you'd have, you know, images of like the animals in Central Park or the rats. So I took a lot of notes, and a lot of it has made it onto the album.
Who has seen the biggest rat? People want to know. I saw him in the basement a long time ago. Jimmy said he saw a rat bigger than his head. It fell down from the ceiling. It ran across the bed.
Yeah, I stayed in New York for COVID too, and I remember very well the rats. It's both a serious song and a funny song.
It's filming in Barzini's. They've got nothing to eat, like the gangs in West Side Story. They're fighting in the street. Part of COVID landscape.
You hoped that it would connect during the rat forum or something?
The international inaugural rat summit. This was exciting to me. I thought, wow, people are going to come to New York and try and solve this rat problem. It barely made the news that week because of Mayor Adams and his issues. I don't know whether that's telling. But you're right. It's a funny song, but it's also true.
You know who I wanted to ask you about, actually, as we were talking about sort of early influence, is a name that's come up for me, and it's before my time. I've been part of a songwriting community for years that traces its lineage to Jack Hardy. Can you just talk about what the songwriting scene was when you were starting out and help me position Jack in all of that?
Oh, sure. Jack was, I would say, very much a leader for a group of us who loved songwriting and loved songwriting for the poetry of it and the politics of it. And Jack couldn't stand it talking about business or anything. He didn't want to talk about chart success or any of that stuff. So I, as a young woman, when I was in my 20s, came down there from Barnard College. And I found it a really good group to be part of. You could talk to them, I had many friends from that group. And Jack is in some of the songs and has influenced some of the songs. His most common complaint for my songs was that he felt that I should work harder on the melodies. Whereas I thought melody was okay, but I also came from a world where rhythm was really important. And what became rap later, like that side of life was very important from where I came from, which was East Harlem and the Upper West Side in the 70s, which was, you know, that's not Jack's world. Jack's world was the sort of the world of Irish poetry and beautiful melodies. So I felt I could pick and choose because I felt I was modern.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I was told was that there was no repeating of songs. You had to play a new song. You had to play his guitar.
Oh, I don't know about you had to play his guitar. Most people didn't want to bring their own guitars because it's a pain in the ass to bring it down on the subway.
Yeah.
So we played Jack's guitar because it was there. And you were not encouraged to bring like a little keyboard and play on a keyboard, although sometimes people did. But it had to be a new song. And yeah, it had to have, you know, some kind of poetic intention, something other than like, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus. You know, that wasn't interesting to him.
Ah. So what did you make of that? Because on the one hand, he was saying, you know, focus on melody, which is a relatively reasonable thing to suggest to a songwriter. And on the other hand, he wasn't necessarily tied to the sort of popular structure. He was looking for something more.
Well, like ballads. You know, if he sang a ballad, he was thrilled. If he had a good chorus, yeah. You want a good chorus. But as in terms of like crafting a perfect 3-minute pop song, he couldn't care less about that. You know, things would strike him a certain way. And of course, there was a lot of wine.
Yeah.
You had to take everything with a grain of salt as the evening went on because
of wine. Did it get in your head? Do you think it influenced your writing?
You know, to be honest, I have my own standards of writing. And so there were times where I would write a song and I would think this would please him. For example, when I wrote the song The Queen and the Soldier, right up Jack's alley, I remember thinking, Jack will like this one. And he did. And a lot of other people, too.
The soldier came knocking upon the queen's door. He said, I am not fighting for you anymore. And the queen knew she'd seen his face someplace before. And slowly she led him inside.
Most of the time, I was working to my own standards and whatever I heard in my own mind. Once in a while, I'd go, oh, Jack's going to complain that I'm being lazy with the melody. You know, maybe I'll tinker with it. But I really work more from the inside.
Yeah. What do you think that community made of your success? You were sort of the first breakout or the breakout of that crew.
But I don't know. Some people were fine. Others complained. Some complained, why her and not me? I got some of that to my face, like, why you and not me? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I have my own answers for why that might be. But but other people were like, some people were annoyed that I was successful, but then others were annoyed that I didn't come down for a drink anymore. But, you know, I was on tour. But the fact is also, I came back in 2000. I did an interview with Jack, and I was struggling with material, and I'd been through a divorce. So he said, come back to the meetings. And I did. And so all the songs from the Songs in Red and Gray album were songs that I had tried out at the meetings years later, 20 years later.
The reproach on your daughter's most beautiful face made me wonder just how she could know of that something that happened between you and me so much more than a long time. Her mother, I can see, lives within her still. 'Cause she looked at me with her eyes. Though I had only just met her right then, I feel that she peeled back my guilty disguise.
This question of why her and not me, or this confusion around success, I mean, it leads to this question that I often have asked those who have been fortunate to be able to answer this question, which is, how does one recover from their own success? You find yourself in a moment where you've really connected with a larger audience and you've got to figure out what to do next. When you think about how you responded to the success of those hits, and then, of course, you managed to have a very productive and prolific creative output since then, what was it like for you to have to figure out, okay, who do I want to be now that this is here for me?
With me, I guess because my values are generally family and life, I put my life ahead of success in a sense. When I had the big success, it was overwhelming sometimes. It was exhausting, a little confusing. Suddenly I'm at parties with like Debbie Harry and like, you know, meeting people, and Richard Gere gave me his phone number. I mean, I just laughed. I thought that was really funny. He's a famous movie star. I put it in my scrapbook. So, you know.
He's probably just sitting at home waiting for a furniture delivery if you call him, though.
I don't know what he's doing. But what I was thinking of is, when am I going to have a family? Mm-hmm. You know, that was first and foremost in my mind. So I still continued making albums. You know, I ended up making Days of Open Hand, and then I made 99.9. And all through that time period, I'm thinking, when am I going to have a family? That was my goal. That becomes my priority. And in a sense, it still is. So my life is my priority. I feel I've had a great career because I'm able to continue touring, doing what I love, and I can still engage an audience. I like seeing the younger generation of women musicians. You know, I'm interested in like Billie Eilish. I'm interested in Boy Genius and just a ton of women making music. So I feel I learn from them sometimes as well as I feel I'm participating in the world of music.
Well, you directly participated in the world of young female artists because your daughter, Ruby, is one of them. She belongs to a young generation of music makers. She sings on your record. She's also part of your musical life in your professional life and also belongs to the family category. Clearly.
Yeah, although her priorities right now are, she got a PhD in biology. That's what her day job is that she's working in laboratories doing research. But she's a terrific musician, and she sings so well, and she writes her own music, and I'm really happy about that.
Knowing how complicated it is and how challenging it is to be an artist, and even given all the successes, how unpredictable it is, her father's also a musician and a producer. I mean, was there a part of you that hoped that she would be a musician, or hoped that she wouldn't be, or had feelings about it one way or the other?
Well, interestingly, when she was young growing up, we found interviews where I said, you know, what I hope for Ruby, I had these ideas that she would go on and help the world and be a marine biologist. And I imagined her like, you know, apparently I had this fantasy that she would put on a lab coat and go into the lab. And that was when she was like 2.5 or 3. And so interestingly, that's what she's done. But Ruby is a very strong personality. And I took her touring constantly. I took her on tour starting from when she was 6 months old. By the time she was 11, she was really over it. Mm-hmm. And she let me know that. She told me point blank, I don't want that kind of life. And I was like, that kind of life, this fabulous life that we get to go on tour, and it's like, you know, it's not for everybody. So I think she loves music, but the touring life, I think, can grind you down if you're not, if to me, I see it as a world of opportunity, and I love it, but I don't think it's for everyone.
Yeah. Well, it lets you really sit in your musical space too. I mean, I always feel the thing about being on tour is that you've got one job. Today, you've got two jobs. You have to talk to me, then you've got to go to Indiana and play. But basically your job is you've just got to get to the stage tonight and do your show.
Yeah.
And no matter what else happens, it's kind of irrelevant. It simplifies life in a way.
Yeah. And there's just the love of doing it also, the love of putting on the show, which I always had. I'm the oldest of 4 children. And then my parents would say, go take these kids and do something. And so I would put on a show, a puppet show or singing or whatever. And so this is an outgrowth of that. It's just basically a bigger audience.
So you see what you're doing today as an outgrowth of the puppet shows or the go entertain yourself of growing up.
That's right. I tell anecdotes. We don't do actual puppet shows, but, you know, it's may as well be. I have all the characters who are speaking, and it's kind of like that.
Yeah. You're one of 4, and you refer to your parents, but when you talk about your parents, my understanding is you're actually talking about the man who turned out to be your stepfather, and you learned later on that your biological father was not that man.
That's right. When I say it's my stepfather, Ed Vega.
He was also a writer?
He was a writer, yeah. And he loved the arts and loved all the arts and always encouraged us to be artistic. And interestingly, when I met my actual birth dad, I found out that his parents were vaudeville musicians who had gone on tour. My grandmother was a drummer and my grandfather was a trumpet player in the Midwest vaudeville circuit. So I thought, oh, that explains a lot. The trooper mentality.
They kind of both may explain a lot. I mean, on the one hand, you had this sort of the literary figure in your house who was interested in writing and reading and storytelling. And then in your blood, you had the performers.
Yeah, music and performance. Yeah. And then my mom, who's very analytical, she was a computer systems analyst. So we embraced technology. I would come home in the 70s and she had a computer in the kitchen that was about as big as a small refrigerator. And she had the modem hooked up through the telephone to the library at Hunter College. She was downloading information. I came in to get a sandwich, so I didn't really, it was like, oh, okay. But my mom's, so that's also filters in.
Yeah. Was it a foregone conclusion that you were going to be an artist, do you think?
Well, I've always been attracted to the stage. I remember seeing a stage when I was about 4 years old. And it was before anybody was on it. So it was just a stage with a spotlight. And I remember being attracted to that space. I was like, you know, I want to be there. I want to be on right there on that stage with the light on it. I have no idea who came on afterwards, what they did. But I remember thinking, that looks good to me.
It's like the stage made a bigger impact than whatever happened on the stage after you discovered it.
Yeah, it kind of. Yeah, because I actually didn't see that many shows. That show that I saw with Lou Reed was, I was 19 by the time I saw Lou Reed. I had participated in shows with like Pete Seeger.
Wait, tell me about that.
Oh, yeah, I was 12 years old, and I was going to a very progressive school in New York, and Pete Seeger did a benefit for our for our school and some other progressive schools. So he came to our school to pick a bunch of kids to sit at his feet and sing along with Pete. And I knew the songs because my parents had played them. And I was determined to be one of the kids that he chose. So I stood really close to him. I sang Guantanamera as loudly as I could. I'm proud to say I was chosen, but I think every kid on the stoop was chosen to be at his feet. And my sister was there, and it was great. I mean, we played Carnegie Hall and we sat at Pete Seeger's feet. And that was probably my first real performance as a singer.
And you started writing songs. You had written a few songs.
A couple years later, I'd already started playing guitar, but it took a long 3 years to write my first song, which, you know, when you're 14, that's a long time.
Sure. Yeah, I know. It's hard to remember that. I mean, 3 weeks is a long time when you're, I have a 13-year-old daughter. 3 weeks is like an eternity for her. But were you listening at that point to Dylan? And I mean, who were you into at 14 years old?
I love Bob Dylan. First of all, I knew him because they played him in school. They played Blowing in the Wind.
Yeah.
And they played a lot of his folky stuff. And then I started hearing him on the radio. How does it feel? You know, that was like mind-blowing. So I was listening to Dylan, and I discovered Leonard Cohen.
As a young teenager, you discovered Leonard Cohen?
Yeah, I had discovered his first album. But the very first song was influenced by Woody Guthrie, because I'd found a collection of folk songs that someone had thrown away. It was like a Folkways collection of four albums of folk song and minstrelsy. So I took this home. I got it for super cheap. And I found I could play the songs because the chords were so simple. So that's what I spent a lot of time doing that. And my very first song was kind of a country western song, which is, it's included in the close-up series.
Sunny boy, you need new sneakers. I'd better go into town and get them Friday night. Come to think of it, kid, you need just about everything. But I think everything will be all right. So you went and got yourself back into trouble. Went and got yourself into another fight. Come on here, let me see your eye now. It's all black and swollen, but I think everything will be all right.
Suzanne Vega. So many things we didn't talk about, but so many things we did talk about. It's been such a pleasure, and I'm inspired by you. Congratulations on your new record.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.